We've been working our way through the Sermon on the Mount, and again, recall that we have come to that part of Christ's teaching where he deals with the issue of divorce and remarriage, and here we pause for a series of more instructional messages on the issue. And as we finish up this series, we'll return back to the Sermon on the Mount, more traditional expositional type of sermons. Today, then, will be the final sermon in this series. And we want to look at 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, which is a passage that often raises questions in people's mind about this issue. 1 Timothy 3, 2, as Paul gives the list of qualifications for a bishop, or it would be an elder, he says, "A bishop, then, must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, and apt to teach." And you will note in this list of qualifications the reference to being the husband of one wife. Now, that phrase is also used in Titus 1:6, where Paul reiterates the qualifications for elders. It is also listed as a requirement for deacons down here in chapter 3 and verse 12. The question then is, what does this phrase mean? We're going to look at several possibilities, considering the pros and cons, the strengths and weaknesses of the various interpretations. But before we look at further at the scriptures this morning, would you join me for a word of prayer? Our Father in heaven, today we seek your guidance. And we ask that you would illumine our understanding as we look at the Word and try to wrestle with the interpretation of this passage and its application, that we might be workmen who are not ashamed, but who dealt faithfully with the Word of God and seek to represent it in our lives and to seek to honor you as we honor your Word. And so we ask your blessing on this worship as we submit and bow the knee before the Word of God. And this we do in the name of Jesus the Christ. Amen. We talk about the interpretations of this passage. There are eight common interpretations, a lot of different ways to approach one simple little phrase. And let's begin by working through some of these. And I'm actually going to start with the last one on the list. This would be an interpretation that I think reads too much into the expression. It is the interpretation that really, a person can't be married at all. This is the view of the Roman Catholic Church, because they suggest that actually an elder needs to be married only to Christ or to the church. The one wife, the only wife that the elder can have, then really is the church. And then so the call is to be committed solely to them. Now, there are some real weaknesses with this interpretation. First of all, of course, it does violate the kind of analogy that we see in the Bible, where the church's relationship to Christ is represented in terms of a marriage relationship. Because if the elder is seen as being married to Christ, well, certainly the analogy here would have it backwards, because Christ would be the husband and the elder perhaps should be the bride. If we see the elder as being married to the church, again, we would have it wrong. Clearly, Christ is viewed as the husband of the church, not the elder. We would not wish to see the elder supplanting that position of Christ. So it really does violate the analogy there. But beyond this, clearly this cannot be of the right interpretation, because what becomes clear is that the elder is envisioned as having a physical wife and children. Indeed, as we've noted, the same requirement is listed for deacons. Let's jump down to chapter 3, verses 11 through 12, where we see that expression in a broader context. Speaking of deacons, he says, "Even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own house as well." Now, in this context, again, you see in verse 12, the deacons are said to be the husbands of one wife, but he also references the idea that they have children and a household and a home, and he talks about their wives in verse 11. So clearly, those who are deacons have a physical wife and very real and physical children. Similarly, then, the list of requirements for elders in Timothy and Titus reference the children of the elder, the idea that he would have children and a home and a family. So, you can't rule out any physical marriage and say he's to be married only to Christ or to the church. A further observation that's noteworthy is that in 1 Corinthians 7:9, and we'll actually read that passage a little later this morning, but there, Paul would argue that those without the gift of celibacy should marry, not refrain from marriage. And we've previously seen in Matthew 19, verses 11 through 12, that Christ argues that celibacy is a rare gift. That's more the exception than the rule. And then we've seen the problems in the Catholic Church resulting from those without a gift of celibacy entering into the priesthood. there is an application which certainly we take away from this. It is true that we should be totally devoted to Christ and sold out to Christ and His service. And you do well to ask yourself this morning, are you really sold out to the Lord? I mean, is the Lord the priority in your life? Or is He just one of many things that you cram into a busy lifestyle when you can fit Him in? Nonetheless, making the Lord a priority in your life does not preclude one from being married and raising a family for His glory. So we can pretty easily dispense that on biblical and exegetical grounds, that He is envisioned as having a physical family. Secondly, there would be this interpretation that there should be no remarriage after the death of the spouse. This takes the words very literally, the husband of one wife. Well, if my first wife dies and I would remarry, well, I would be on wife number two, a second wife. And so they would prohibit any remarriage subsequent to the death of a spouse. This is the view of the Eastern Orthodox Church, or the Russian Orthodox Church. So if you have a priest in their church and his wife dies, that's it. He must then remain celibate the rest of his life there. But again, this interpretation does not work. Exegetically, we've got solid grounds for rejecting this. Again, as overreading the expression. Technically, yes, you could say that, well, this would be wife number two. But clearly that can't be what Paul means when he speaks of being a husband of one wife. Let me illustrate why. If you'll jump later in the same epistle, down to chapter 5 and verses 9 and 10. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 9 through 10. Paul here, in the context, is talking about the qualifications that elderly widows would have to meet if they would be added onto the church rolls to receive financial support, where the church is going to take them in. Now, this is a situation where she's truly a destitute person. She has no family to look out for her and to take care of her. So she's not only does she not have a husband, she doesn't have kids and family and relatives that can be looking out for her. Then Paul says, well, then the church can step in and help provide for her if some qualifications are met. Now notice the qualifications here. If she's going to be on the church rolls, verses 9 and 10, he says, let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man, well reported of for good works. If she brought up children, if she lodged strangers, if she washed the saints' feet, if she relieved the afflicted, if she have diligently followed every good work. So you can see the kind of qualification here. She has to have been a good, godly woman throughout her life. And one of the things that's true, of course, she has to be 60 years of age. But also the last part of verse 9 says she must have been the wife of one man. Now note that expression. Actually, in the Greek, this expression is exactly parallel to the expression that Paul uses back in chapter 3 when speaking of the elders. He just simply reverses it. The husband of one wife in 1 Timothy 3. Here, it's really that she was really just the wife of one husband. She only had one husband. But grammatically, it's exactly parallel. So he's making the same inquirement for these widows that he did for the elders. Now, with that in mind, jump down to verse 14, where then, as Paul talks about the whole issue of providing for widows, he now turns his attention from the elderly widows, to younger widows, those under the age of 60, or perhaps even significantly younger. Verse 14, he says, I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. So in the instance where you have a younger widow, he says, now I want them to marry. And instead of expecting the church to provide for them, she's a young woman, let her go out and catch herself a man. Get herself a husband who can provide and take care of her. Let her have some children who can provide for her in her elderly years. That should not be the burden, the responsibility of the church. So she needs to go out and then try to, you know, start a family. So he tells the younger widows, go out and get yourself married. Now, if the phrase then about having been the wife of only one husband means, very literally, that if your first husband died, Paul expects you to remain single the rest of your life, that elderly widow could have married another man, then why would Paul command the younger widows to do something that would disqualify them from receiving church assistance in their sunset years? They would be in a position of saying, well, I'm disqualified from receiving church assistance in my older years because I obeyed Paul. Because suppose that she's a widow and she does remarry, in obedience to Paul, but the second husband dies. And now she's in her elderly years, she's in her 60s or her 70s, she has no husband and maybe she has no kids, no relatives to take care of her. Yet she, in that circumstance, could not receive a church assistance because the church would look back and say, no, because when your first husband died, you remarried another man, you obeyed Paul, and now because you did what Paul said, you're disqualified. obviously, I think Paul would not be putting a woman in that position. And so clearly, when he uses that exact same grammatical expression, by that he is not prohibiting remarriage subsequent to the death of a spouse. That has always been understood as something that is perfectly acceptable in the Bible, that death is viewed as dissolving the marriage bond. It's not a problem. It represents no stain on the person's character whatsoever. And so therefore, Paul would not disqualify a woman on the basis that she might have perhaps married a second time if the second husband had also died. So we really can rule out both the views of the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. These are reading too much into the expression here. Then there is perhaps the opposite extreme. Instead of ruling out marriage, there are those who, on the other end of the spectrum, would say, well, you have to be married. After all, how can you be the husband of one wife if you have no wife at all? So that they would read Paul as actually commanding marriage. But, again, that would not really be understanding the phrase accurately. We have exegetical grounds for ruling that out. Hold your place here. Let me turn your attention to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 8 through 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 8 through 9. Paul here is addressing the circumstances, the scenario where you have those that have been widowed, and the issue is, should they remarry subsequent to the death of their spouse? Now, we don't know Paul's personal situation, if he had ever been married, but we know at the time that he wrote 1 Corinthians, he was not married. And there is some question whether he had ever been married. It is possible, but we're not clear on this from a statement in the book of Acts, that he may at one time had been a member of the Sanhedrin. And it is also possible that the Sanhedrin may have required all members of the Sanhedrin to be married. But we don't know that that was true either prior to 70 A.D. So, one, we don't even know if he was a member of the Sanhedrin. We don't know that even if he was, that he would have been required to be married. If he ever was married, his spouse apparently had died by the time he wrote 1 Corinthians 7. So, in this context, in verses 8 through 9, he says, I say, therefore, to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. In verse 8, when he says it's better for them to abide even as I, he means to remain unmarried. You know, if you can, that frees you up for a lot of service to the Lord. But on the other hand, if you don't have that gift for celibacy, then by all means, marry. You know, Paul recognized that he's the exception in that regard. So, Paul clearly is not married. That's what he's saying. Abide as I. Abide unmarried. If you can. Well, now, Paul was an apostle. Paul carried the title of elder. Therefore, if Paul was requiring that elders be married, Paul was violating his own requirement. He himself was not married. And therefore, again, this is an example where you can't derive that from the expression that he is taking that as a requirement. Obviously, Paul is not listing this then as a requirement so much as he is assuming it. He is taking it as a given that most men are married, and taking that as a given then that he would be the husband of one wife. Now, many churches today do insist on having a pastor who is married. They want to be able to have a pastor who can maybe set an example of how to be married, you know, how a man should treat his wife and so forth. And so they would require that. And that's fine if a church wishes to have that as a requirement, if that's, you know, the kind of the pastor that they want. But they need to be sure that, and clear in their understanding, that they're not doing that based upon a biblical mandate. Again, Paul is not mandating that a pastor be married. That's more a matter of their personal preference. And as a point of application, again, this reminds us that we must always be careful to distinguish between what the Bible explicitly says versus our preferences and our traditions. We don't want to go where the Pharisees did, where they took the traditions of men and the commandments of men, and they began to put them on a level with the authority of God's Word. And when all that gets jumbled up, well, we've always done it this way. Well, I always felt it was best to have a married pastor. Well, fine, feel free to feel that way. But don't jumble that all up together as if, and God mandates that. Clearly, he doesn't, because Paul was not married. So, certainly, Paul also elsewhere makes clear that the apostles have a right to be married if they want and have a family. And it's not unrealistic for the apostles to expect that the churches, their ministries, would support them and a family. It's not as if, well, you know, if you're going to be a pastor, you have to be single, so it's cheaper for the church to provide for you. No, it's perfectly fair and legitimate. Paul says for a man in ministry to be married and to have a family. and the ministry ought to be willing to support a man with a family. But it's also true that a man does not have to be married. So that goes beyond biblical data. Then there is this position, position number two, that says, well, what he's really doing is he's prohibiting polygamy. This goes on the opposite extreme of what we saw. I think the positions about no remarriage or no marriage at all is reading too much into the expression. Seeing this merely as a prohibition of polygamy, on the other hand, reads too little into the expression. It is the opposite problem. We can absolutely, again, rule that out as a possibility. That can't be primarily what Paul has in mind. He's just saying, well, we can't have pastors having two wives at a time. Now, polygamy was, first of all, not particularly common in the ancient Roman world of Paul's day. Divorce and remarriage was rampant. That was a problem. But polygamy was not particularly common in ancient Roman culture. I mean, if a man wanted another wife, he just dumped the first wife and took a second one. He wasn't just adding and multiplying, you know, all these wives to take care of. But what was even more rare is the idea where you would have a woman with multiple husbands. That did not take place. So you might have a husband that has multiple wives, but women did not have multiple husbands. Now, why is that cultural understanding significant? Well, 1 Timothy 5:9, the passage we already read about the elderly widows. Remember, one of the qualifications is she must be the husband of one wife. Remember, that's the exact same grammatical expression. Paul can't be saying here, well, she's got to be a woman that didn't have multiple husbands at the same time. Why would he be saying that? Women didn't have multiple husbands at the same time. Why would he be ruling out something that wasn't an issue and wasn't a problem? Culturally and historically, then, to suggest that what he has in mind is polygamy really won't work. Because, you know, polyandry, that is, having multiple husbands, certainly can't be what he's talking about in 1 Timothy 5:9. So, correspondingly, when he uses the exact same grammatical expressions with elders, he can't be ruling out polygamy, that is, having multiple wives at the same time. So we've ruled out four interpretations, some that read too much into the expression, some that maybe miss the point or read too little into the expression, at least four remaining interpretations. And as we've seen, some are over-reading and some are under-reading the text. So apparently the truth lies somewhere in the middle, leads us in the direction of one of the remaining four interpretations in the middle. And at this point then, it has become clear that we cannot interpret this phrase by dissecting it into its individual words and then interpreting those words in an entirely literal meaning. After all, if we stress the words in an overly literal way, then we would be requiring that a minister be married. Because at its most literal level, how can you be the husband of one wife when you have no wife? Or how could a man remarry after the death of his first spouse? If you want to get technical and overly literalistic. And as we've seen from exegetical standpoint, he can't possibly be ruling out those possibilities. Therefore, we have to be careful that we don't read too much into the expression. And hence, it must be a phrase that intends to convey a general idea that transcends the strictly literalistic meaning of the exact words. Or perhaps a better way of saying this, it is a phrase that is intended to be understood in somewhat of a restricted way. And so that leads us to consider the next three possible interpretations, all of which are far more reasonable, would have to be approaching closer to the truth. The next interpretation, then, would be this idea that he must be a man who's faithful and devoted to his wife. And that's a common view that is out there. The idea being that this is a man who's totally in love with his wife. There's no room in his life for other women. Meaning, not just that, well, he didn't physically divorce her, but that we mean he doesn't cross any kind of ethical lines in the sense that he kind of is flirtatious with other women. Or even if he hadn't physically cheated on his wife, he's kind of be guilty of the mental or emotional affairs and that type of thing. This is a man, though, who truly loves his wife and is devoted to her. And so they would understand this as a qualification, not merely that the man has gone through met the letter of the law and that he never technically divorced his wife, but it's pretty obvious there's not too much love in this marriage. But it's that, man, this is a man that really loves his wife. And that's the requirement, that a pastor has to truly love his wife and be in love with her, and it ought to be a marriage where there's love, and that ought to be obvious. And that then would be the qualification that Paul is setting. Now, the argument is based upon the nature of the Greek expression, the way that expression is worded. You could translate it this way, that he must be a one-woman man, or a one-woman kind of man. The Greek does give it that kind of feel. And when you word it that way in English, I think you do get more of the sense that a one-woman man, or a one-woman kind of man, that what we're getting here is a description of a character trait. He's faithful. He's devoted. A character trait. In which case, this would fit in with the other requirements in the list, which tend to deal more with character traits. And hence the focus in this list of requirements from the Apostle Paul, here and as well as in Titus for the elder, is not focused so much upon his circumstances in life. The focus is not upon his marital status. Is he single? Is he married? Is he widowed? Is he divorced? Not a matter of circumstances or status, but more focused upon his character. That's the interpretation. And that is a noteworthy observation. The Greek does tend to have that feel to it. However, the argument cannot entirely be made on the basis that that must be what he's describing, because the context deals with character traits. For example, if you look at 1 Timothy 3:2, again, notice the very last part of verse 2. What is the last requirement mentioned there? Apt to teach. Now, that expression, 1 Timothy 3:2 there, apt to teach, that means he has a gift, a talent, an ability for teaching. Well, a talent, a gift, an ability, that's not a character trait. A person can be a very godly man, a very spiritually minded man, filled with the fruit of the Spirit, cannot have a gift for teaching. Okay? The ability to teach, that's not a character trait. That's a gift. Either you got it or you don't. Either God gave it to you or he didn't. That's not something you grow into through spiritual maturity. Now, it's a gift you might have and you might need to hone and develop. But again, clearly, not everybody has a gift for teaching, but that's one of the requirements. In Ephesians 4, Paul refers to pastors as pastor teachers. You would hyphenate that. They're pastor teachers. That's what he calls them. By definition, a pastor should be a teacher. So that's not a character trait. And then if you look down at verse 6, notice in verse 6 in 1 Timothy 3, he says that he must not be a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Not a novice. Well, that's more an issue of his what's been true since his salvation experience. It's not so much an issue of his character, more an issue of how long he's been saved and what kind of life experience he's had as a saved person. But it's a little bit more of a circumstance. By the way, in this regard, churches often get it backwards. Churches often want and insist upon having an older, more mature man whom they can say he's had more life experience. They're less concerned about how long he's been saved and how well grounded he is in the Scripture. The assumption is if he's an older man, he's a more mature man, that's what we want. Why, we wouldn't certainly want a young man leading the church. Of course, Timothy, the very man to whom Paul was writing, was a young man and was an elder. And Paul had told him, let no man despise thy youth. God is not opposed to using young men. David was still quite young when he slew Goliath and then went forth and was leading the Israelite armies in battle and in war. He was quite young. The difference is that Timothy had been saved as a very young individual, had grown up around the Scriptures, and was well grounded. The issue was not his physical age, the issue was his spiritual age. And many churches would do well to focus more upon one's spiritual age than his physical age, his spiritual maturity, than the issue of physical maturity. I can tell you today, many churches today would absolutely, as a matter of principle, refuse to call Timothy as their pastor. They would rule him out merely on the basis of his age. Age too young. And since there is age discrimination in the church, but it's kind of a reverse age discrimination. And I feel far too many young men are not given the opportunity to lead and to continue to grow and develop in the church. Because too many churches, and you know, they all want the older man. We want a middle-aged man, some guy in his 50s who's great, you know, and so forth. We don't want some guy in his, 20s or early 30s. But the main point here then, perhaps that's a little bit of an aside, the main point in here is that this, again, is not so much a character trait. It's an issue of how long he's been saved. That's a matter of his circumstances. In God's sovereignty, maybe the guy got saved later in life, but he might not have been saved that many years. Now, he might be growing very well as a Christian. He might be on track, you could say, with his growth, as he's grown as much as you could reasonably expect a believer to grow. He might be a man of great character. At the point, we could look and see no flaws in his character. But none of that matters if he simply hasn't been saved long enough and been tried and tested. It does not matter that the man has flawless character if he has not been saved long enough. Now, Paul doesn't tell us how long enough is, but he ought to have been saved long enough that his salvation has been put to the test before he is put in a leadership position. And again, far too many people in church are put in leadership positions who have not been saved long enough simply because they have talents or because they have godly character, but they're missing the test, being well tested over time. And then finally, Titus 1:9, if you'll turn over to the parallel passage in Titus, where again, as we mentioned, he gives a list of requirements for elders. In Titus 1:9, note this requirement. Titus 1:9, he speaks of what must be true of the elder in these terms, that he must be one who is holding fast the faithful word as he hath been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convince the gainsayers. According to Titus 1:9, an elder must be somebody who has been well taught in the Scriptures. He's knowledgeable. He's been taught. He's not just a fellow, but he's got a good heart, and he's godly in his lifestyle, so he loves the Lord, he's got a lot of zeal, and there's no character flaws. Yeah, but he must also be well taught. Taught well enough he can stand up to the cults and the false teachers and recognize false doctrine when it come in when they come into the church. Well enough grounded and taught in the Word that he is a leader and not a follower. So he's not running after the latest mega church pastor who's wrote the latest bestseller and how to grow a big church. Because he can actually read the Bible for himself and figure out how to lead the church. He's not a man, although there is obviously in the concept of mentoring, the elder and more experienced mentoring the younger, you need to be very careful that he's not a guy who's idolizing these other big famous pastors of these big churches, because at the end of the day, he really doesn't have confidence in his own ability to interpret the Scriptures. He'd better be well taught, and he'd better be confident. I know what this says. I know what it says in the Greek. I know what it says in the Hebrew. I don't stand in the pulpit and say, well, I've always heard. I stand in the pulpit and say, thus saith the Lord. Now, that is a matter of training and education. That's not a character trait. Being taught is an opportunity that needs to be afforded to him, and he must have it. Now, it can come in a formal setting, such as seminary, a non-formal setting, no matter how it comes, but it must come. But that's not a character trait. That's knowledge. That's education. That's skill that he's acquired. So the argument is based upon Paul is giving us a list of character traits, and when you look at it, they're not entirely true. Some character traits, but some of these things are not character traits. He has to have a gift. He has to have education. He has to have been saved for a certain amount of time. Another observation about this idea that he's really describing this, the character trait of the pastor, again, is that it does not really, I think, and this would be, of course, my sense of the term, but it doesn't really account for that unusual expression, husband of one wife. If Paul is just saying, he's got to be faithful and devoted to his wife, why not just say something like that? Let him be devoted to his wife. Faithful to his wife. You can say that in Greek as you can say it in English, but instead that expression, husband of one wife, is a little bit of an unusual way of wording it. And of course, then there is this observation, though. If he is fully devoted to his wife, madly in love with his wife, and sold out to her in his heart, then he would never divorce her or marry someone else, even if she had abandoned him. So inevitably, the discussion leads to the issue of divorce and remarriage. Some will try to interpret the text in such a way to avoid that highly controversial issue. Like, well, he's just saying she's faithful and devoted. We're not even going to the issue. This has nothing to do with whether he's been divorced or remarried. How can you leave that out of the discussion? I don't think you can avoid that question. All the more so since divorce and remarriage was absolutely rampant in the society in which Paul lived, and it would have been an issue in his day. So let us consider some of the interpretations then that deal with the issue of divorce and remarriage. There is this interpretation that says, well, he can't be divorced and remarried unless it was on biblical grounds. Now, obviously, this would be a position held only by those who hold the traditional Protestant interpretation that there are the couple exceptions in Scripture. If the wife was immoral, violated the marriage bonds, or if he was abandoned by an unbeliever. Say, for example, you know, they were both pagans and he gets saved, his wife doesn't, and she ends up abandoning him because of that. Now, those who hold a permanent view of marriage obviously wouldn't adopt this position because they don't think there are any biblical grounds. But as I said, the traditional Protestant view is that there are two grounds of divorce, and they would say that really all Paul is saying is that if he was divorced and remarried, it needed to be on those biblical grounds. If he didn't really have grounds for the divorce and remarriage, then he has been disqualified from being an elder because he has violated that biblical principle. And, of course, by the act of remarriage, he would have been guilty of adultery because he may be divorced in society's eyes, but he's not divorced in God's eyes unless it was, you know, a biblically grounded divorce. Problem with that interpretation. In the Greek expression here, that term one is emphatic. Paul goes out of his way to emphasize that word one when he's with the husband of one wife. And it's really hard to account for that emphasis upon that word one. If, in fact, well, really, he could have more than one wife, as long as it falls within the usual rules and the usual boundaries. Now, we've acknowledged that on the one hand, the phrase is not entirely open-ended. Paul does use it in somewhat of a restricted way. Again, remember that he does not rule out taking a second wife subsequent to the death of the first. We know that he, on the other hand, does not require a person to be married so that he could be the husband of one wife. So the expression is somewhat restricted, yes. But in those cases, we know that Paul is excluding those as exceptions because we have specific texts that make that clear. We know Paul is not saying that, you know, a pastor can't remarry if his first wife dies. Because, we have texts for that. We know that Paul can't be saying a pastor must be married because we have a text for that. Paul wasn't married. But in this case, in the case of divorce and remarriage, we have no such text in the context of ministry requirements that would prove that he's using the phrase so narrowly as to prohibit only an unbiblical divorce or remarriage. You're stepping beyond the biblical data. And to rest so much on an interpretation that goes beyond biblical data is, to me, a little bit shaky. The interpretation strikes me as a little bit arbitrary. On what basis, then, we would allow certain divorces and remarriage? I mean, I understand, yes, that some would be viewed as permitted by Scripture and some not. But Paul doesn't seem to be going into the ones that are permitted and not permitted here. And furthermore, if that is specifically what Paul has in mind, why not say so in more clear terms? And that's really specifically what he's talking about. I don't want him to be divorced or remarried unless it was on biblical grounds. He could have said so. Christ stated, in clear terms, an exception on the grounds of fornication. Paul, in 1 Corinthians, states an exception for desertion by an unbeliever. Why could not Paul here make clear that he's holding pastors to the standards of marriage previously articulated by Christ and himself, using similar terminology instead of this unusual expression? Indeed, it's quite possible that Paul intends to hold pastors to a higher standard than he holds lay people to. So for the traditional Protestants who recognize that God does give permission for divorce and remarriage, on those two grounds, nonetheless, they would say that God is holding a pastor to a higher standard than he is the average Christian. Paul then would be requiring ministers to exemplify the ideal standard for marriage that we find in Genesis. Certainly, we know that in his ministry, though he permitted the exception, Christ took greater pains to stress the Genesis ideal over any permitted exceptions. And so it's very possible that Paul is requiring ministers to model that ideal. In this area in particular, it's possible that God is setting a higher standard for ministers. Because in the Old Testament, God had higher marital standards for priests. Hold your place here. Let me turn your attention back to Leviticus 21. And let's take a look at God's marital requirements for the priests. Leviticus chapter 21 and verse 7. Leviticus 21 and verse 7. Here God says, and in the context here is speaking of the average priest, and he says, in Leviticus 21:7, that they shall not take a wife that is a whore or profane, neither shall they take a woman put away from her husband, that means divorced, for he is holy unto his God. So a priest could not marry a woman who had been divorced, period. Now, even if she were innocent of any wrongdoing, not that she was divorced because of infidelity on her part or anything like that. He doesn't say, you know, only under certain circumstances, just period if she had been divorced. The priest was not to marry her. And if we jump down to verse 13 through 14, focusing upon the high priest, verse 13 through 14, he says, and he shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow, or a divorced woman, or profane, or harlot, these shall he not take, but he shall take a virgin of his own people to wife. Notice here again, the high priest can't marry a divorced woman. Beyond that, he could not marry a woman who had been previously married but who was widowed. Now, we know that usually, again, that's fine. God says, you know, death dissolves a marriage. Normally, a widower can't remarry. But God did not want the high priest marrying a woman who had been widowed. If you would cross-reference Ezekiel 44:22, we see that in the future, during the restoration of Israel, during the millennial period, again, God holds higher marital standards for the priests. Again, during the millennial period, they cannot marry a woman who had been divorced. Regardless of the grounds of divorce, he doesn't make an exception and say, well, you know, I mean, if she were innocent and hadn't done anything wrong, the husband just, you know, dumped her. No, period, if she'd been divorced. Well, it's not that then there's any stain on her character. I mean, remember, in Jewish culture, the woman's just a piece of property. She has no say-so. If the husband wants to dump her, he can dump her with a piece of paper. She didn't have to have done anything wrong. It doesn't represent any stain on her character. Nonetheless, God does not want the priest to marry the divorced woman. So he is holding a higher standard here that would help to model the Genesis ideal. Now, we have to be careful here because we must maintain the distinction between Israel and the church. Understand that they are very different institutions. I'm not arguing here for the exact same standards for priests versus elders. That's a different type of institution, different setting. And so we're not saying the standards would be exactly the same. But what we are doing here is acknowledging more a general principle. It's not the specifics of the standards. It's the general principle that God does hold higher standards for those in positions of spiritual leadership than he does for the average person. And those standards can even involve the issue of marriage. So, to argue that, well, he could be divorced and remarried as long as it occurred on biblical grounds, as I said, I think there's some weakness there that it doesn't really take into account the expression about, one wife. And it doesn't take into consideration the possibility that God would be holding ministers to a higher standard. And there would have been an easier way of saying that, if that's really primarily what he had in mind. This then leads us to the issue of no divorce and remarriage at all, period. That an elder should never have been divorced and then remarried subsequent to that. Now, obviously, we're talking about remarriage as the primary aspect of that, where he now is a second wife. That interpretation does have the advantage of interpreting the text in its fullest sense without overreading it to the point of contradicting the clearly stated exceptions again about when your spouse has died or requiring that a man be married in order to be a minister. It would read it in a fullest allowable sense. But even here, there are some ambiguities and questions just to make you aware that there is some debate in this regard. Some will raise this issue. Does it matter when the divorce and remarriage occurred? Prior to his salvation or subsequent to his salvation? You know, some would say it's not really relevant if this divorce and remarriage had occurred prior to his salvation. The argument would be drawn from observations such as Titus 1:7, where Paul prohibits excessive wine drinking on the part of an elder. And they say, well, wait a minute. What if this guy had been an alcoholic prior to his salvation? And when he got saved, God delivered him from that, and he's never touched a drop of alcohol since the day he got saved. But he was an alcoholic before he got saved. But no excessive wine drinking sense. What if he'd been a drug addict prior to his salvation? But he hasn't touched drugs since the day he got saved. Indeed, we would consider his life a compelling testimony to the power of God to change a life. And likewise, then the argument is made that we should not hold a divorce and remarriage against the man, let that disqualify him from the opportunity to serve the Lord if that occurred prior to his salvation. The view is basically arguing that if we do that, we're holding forth a double standard. On the one hand, you've got the former drug addict, alcoholic, wife beater, who then gets saved, leave that in the past. As long as it's all in the past, well, he can be a pastor. I mean, he was an alcoholic, drug addict, and a wife beater, but he can be a pastor. Then on the other hand, you got this other fellow who never messed with drugs, never messed with alcohol, never beat his wife, and actually he was a very moral person and a good person. He just was never saved. Now he's gotten saved and become a spiritually minded individual, no character flaws whatsoever, except the one point is that prior to his salvation, his wife abandoned him for another man. Not that he'd ever done anything wrong, but his wife had left him, and then so he remarried on the grounds that she left him and remarried somebody, violated those marriage vows. And then the church would say, but you can't be a pastor. So that is the argument that says it makes a difference whether it occurred before or after. But that's not a foolproof argument. I understand the concern that it seems tragic when you take a good man who was a godly person who has no stains on his character whatsoever and you close the door of ministry to him. But it's not a foolproof argument, and here's why. It may be relevant even if it occurred before salvation. Here's why. The drug addict stopped doing drugs when he got saved. He's not a drug addict anymore. The alcoholic stopped drinking when he got saved. He's not an alcoholic anymore. The wife beater stopped beating his wife when he got saved. But the fellow who divorced his wife and got remarried is still married to that woman after salvation. He's still on a second wife. That didn't change. You see, the other stuff can change, but you can't change the fact that you're still on your second wife. You can't stop being married. And certainly we wouldn't say, well, divorce this wife so you're not on your second wife. I mean, that couldn't change the fact that he was still on his second wife. So it's not exactly parallel. So on the one hand, the argument says, we're holding a double standard here. This guy can have all this junk in his past, and we don't hold that against him. The other guy, we hold this one thing against him. But the other perspective would say, yeah, but the other stuff doesn't carry over. Your marriage does. You're still on wife number two, even after you got saved. Both sides of the argument make good points. It's one of those cases where it's hard to know where to come down on this one. This is a short phrase, but it's one of the trickiest ones in the Scriptures. But then let us move on to a final interpretation, an eighth interpretation. That is the view that can be divorced. Now, it's really hard to know how you could get that from this expression. Man may well have been divorced, but if he never married subsequent to that divorce, it's hard to say he's ever had more than one wife. And the expression says husband of one wife. Technically, he's the husband of only one wife. So it's hard to prohibit divorce on the basis of this expression. Now, many churches will prohibit a divorced man from being in the ministry. Now, like I said, you really can't look at this expression. I just don't see how you can get it out of that. They may look to other requirements for ministry, such as the term blameless. In 1 Timothy 3:2, the first requirement that he mentions, again, is that he must be blameless. He says a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. Well, all right, then that's a different discussion technically. What does the word blameless mean? We're talking about husband of one wife. That's an entirely different expression, but it does kind of come into the discussion. So let's take a couple minutes to address this before we wrap up this morning. What does blameless have to do with the issue? Well, there is the usual assumption that if a man has been divorced, surely he must bear some blame for that divorce. I mean, no one's just going to run off and, you know, leave a man unless, you know, he was less than, you know, the perfect husband. Surely he must bear some responsibility in the marriage falling apart. I will say that's unfair. You cannot assume that. That may often be the case. But to say in every case, as a blanket statement, that that's true without looking at the individual and considering the individual circumstances, it simply is not true. In 1 Corinthians 7, in fact, as we have previously seen, Paul anticipates the possibility that when you've got pagans and they're married and one of them ends up getting saved, that the unsaved partner will not appreciate being married to a Christian and will leave that Christian precisely because he's a Christian. Not because of character flaws, not because of what he's doing wrong, but because of what he's doing right. Let's face it, some people don't want to do what's right with their lives. They don't want to be stuck in a relationship with somebody who's living right. And it is very possible, as Paul acknowledges in 1 Corinthians 7, that a woman might leave a man not because of character flaws, but precisely because he's so unbending in his character. In fact, I knew a man in ministry just like this. He worked a secular job, was also a pastor of a church, and I worked on that job with him for some time. This man had an outstanding Christian testimony. All these lost people who worked with him often made comments like this. They would say, now there's a real Christian. If I were ever going to become a Christian, that's the kind of Christian I'd want to be. I actually heard co-workers make statements like this. If I knew more Christians like him, I'd be in church. I'd go to church and I'd become one. He's such an anomaly. That's why, boy, outstanding testimony. A giving man, a caring man, a compassionate man, a man of unbending character. And for many years he was a pastor. But a few years ago, some years ago, his wife got tired of being a pastor's wife and living such a godly and holy lifestyle. He's so hyper about being holy. She left him. She did not leave the man because of flaw in his character. And I don't think that it is fair for those who have been blessed with a good marriage to point the finger at an individual and automatically assume, well, I don't know any blame, but there must be some there. We really can't make that claim. So I think that reads too much to assume that, well, he can't be without blame because the spouse left him. Some would argue that it's a problem because if he is divorced, that would be a distraction from his ministry. And he's got this issue of the ex-wife who's haranguing him. Maybe he's got alimony payments, child support, child custody issues, all this stuff going on that will distract him from the ministry. It's something people can point to. And those are fair observations. The church certainly has the right to think about these things. But in the real world, there are always going to be distractions and obstacles thrown in our path. And the devil will see that, whatever form they come in, they will be there. To arbitrarily single out one distraction versus the other seems to be exactly that, arbitrary. The Apostle Paul himself had a lot of distractions in his ministry. He was often beaten and imprisoned. He spent 2 years in jail in Caesarea, followed up by another 2 years in jail in Rome. A four-year distraction. A little hard for him to get out there planting churches. A little hard to plant churches while you're sitting in jail. A little hard to be running around checking on your churches. I mean, he could write letters, so that's about all he could do. It was somewhat of a restriction. Well, people furthermore could point to his jail record. You know, this guy's spent time in prison. And not that people won't try to attack us and point out things in our life. The issue here is, are the attacks substantive? Are they legitimate? People are always going to say things. The question is it true? Is it substantive? Is there anything to the claim? Sure, Paul was in prison, but not because he'd done anything wrong. He was in prison because he'd done what was right. He was in prison for preaching the gospel. Now, I am absolutely convinced there are some churches today, I believe there are churches today, if the Apostle Paul himself were alive today, they would not have him as their pastor. They wouldn't. They wouldn't measure up to their standards. But first of all, he's not married. Well, we believe a pastor needs to be married so he can set a good example for us of how to raise a godly family. Paul wasn't married. Well, he spent time in prison. They'd say, I know he didn't do anything wrong. Still, it's just the fact that he was in prison. People can point to that and say, you know, he's a jailbird. Yeah, I don't know. We don't want a pastor who spent time in prison. They wouldn't have Timothy, too young. Wouldn't have Paul, not married. Wouldn't have Paul, spent time in prison. So I think we have to be careful about that type of reasoning. We need to have clear biblical exegetical reasons. The best approach, if a church wishes to prohibit a divorced man from being in ministry, would be to argue that a given church may wish to have a pastor who can model the original design for marriage in Genesis 1. Instead of assuming that by virtue of a divorce that represents a stain on his character or a distraction, perhaps the better approach is just to say, we want a man who models the ideal in Genesis 1. That would be a reasonable expectation for an elder. Yes, Christ permitted exceptions for divorce, but more often he stressed the ideal. And so a man in a leadership position should model not the exception, but the rule. Based on the emphasis of Christ, I think there's a more fair exegetical biblical basis to approach it that way. I'm sympathetic to that understanding. I understand a church not wanting a divorced man, in that position of leadership. Although I will acknowledge that at the end of the day, I'm not sure that I have a verse that explicitly says so in so many words. I don't know that the requirements here, like I said, you can't get that out of husband and one wife, and I don't think you can get out of being blameless. So maybe I'm missing something, and if somebody listening to me, something comes to mind of how you could definitively or explicitly rule it out as a biblical mandate rather than a matter of preference, I'd be open to hearing that. Because again, my mind comes back to the issue of, let's say you get a man who gets saved, his wife doesn't get saved, shortly after the salvation she leaves him precisely because of his Christianity. He never remarries, so he's never had a second wife. She was the only woman ever in his life. He continues to grow in the Lord, serves faithfully, becomes well-grounded, and in every other regard he meets the qualifications. You can't say the divorce represented a defect in his Christian character. It's because of his character that she left him. He's never remarried, so you can't say he's the husband of more than one wife. In that case, it's hard for me to point to something specific in the Scriptures, exegetically, that totally rules the issue out. So I'm sympathetic to that position, but I have to acknowledge personal preference or leanings versus Scripture. And I cannot, in good conscience, confound the two. As I said, I fear far too many churches confound their traditions and preference with biblical mandates. And we cannot do that. Let's not put our thoughts on a par with us at the Lord. So let me conclude then by sharing you how I approach the issue. Three basic principles define how I approach this issue. First, as we have seen, the expression husband and one wife cannot be interpreted, I'd say, in a strictly literalistic way that's entirely open-ended. Because if you did, then you'd say, yeah, you can't even remarry if his spouse died. Or you would require the pastor to be married. Secondly, the expression is not so narrow as to be restricted to ruling out only one specific sin that Paul has in mind, such as polygamy or divorce and remarriage. If that were so, why wouldn't Paul simply use more specific terminology that would actually identify the one thing Paul's prohibiting? No polygamy, or never divorced. He could have said that. Or never remarried. He could have said that. There are ways to say that in Greek. It's very simple than using this roundabout expression, husband of one wife. Instead, then, the term is somewhat broad, falling between the extremes of being entirely open-ended on the one hand and very narrow and restrictive on the other hand. Within that range, it is broad and vague enough to encompass not one idea, but several ideas all at once. I believe that is precisely why Paul uses this unusual expression instead of a specific expression. He's not ruling out one thing in particular. He used a term that was vague because the advantage of the vagueness is it's more generic, it's more broad. He wishes to exclude more than one kind of sin related to the issue of marriage. My understanding then is why he's not primarily thinking of polygamy, and we can prove that exegetically, it would certainly rule that out. But would also say he must be faithful and devoted to his wife. He can't just be a man and say, well, technically he's never been divorced. Well, yeah, that's true, but he's flirting with all the women in the church. That's a problem. I don't care whether he's divorced or not. If he's flirting with all the women in the church, he shouldn't be a pastor. So rules that out. Divorce and remarriage. If he remarried something in a divorce, well, that's more than one wife. And that's not an obvious, he makes no exception there in that case, whether it's on biblical grounds or not. So I think a broad reading perhaps is a more fair way of reading it. You start going this direction, you're going beyond what you can make the word say, but several ideas would be encompassed there. And the third principle that governs my approach is when in doubt, play safe. A lot of good men who love the Lord have different interpretations on this issue. But I would rather be guilty of erring on the safe side than lowering the standard below biblical expectations. Now, it's wrong both to subtract and add to the Scriptures. To go beyond the Scriptures is just wrong as taking something away from the Scriptures. But in this case, you have to make a choice. You have to settle on an interpretation so you can apply it. If I overreach and hold a higher standard than Paul intended, I'd rather be guilty of that error than lowering the standard below God's expressly stated requirements. And then finally, let me conclude then this morning with these observations. I don't claim to arrive at the final definitive answer to this issue. A lot of issues in the Bible I've thought about. I've reached conclusions. I've preached those conclusions. And I do so, with conviction and gusto. Well, on this one, I'll tell you, I'm somewhat tentative. I've been wrestling with this issue for years, and it's a hard expression to nail down. This is where I stand at this point, but if I come back 10 years from now and preach something different, I suppose that could be a possibility. I might read something where somebody could convince me, hey, the Greek grammar really should be read this way or something. But that's where I stand, and that's where I have stood for many years. And finally, as I pointed out, there are other interpretations that I think are fair-minded interpretations. I might not find them entirely compelling, but I think they're fair approaches to the text. So I would not stand in judgment of other churches or ministries that take perhaps one of those other approaches that fall within a reasonable range there. It's not the position that I take, but it's not a case where I would stand up in the pulpit and say, these people are wrong. They have no business having this man in the ministry. Now let's pray.